Miami-Dade's budget shortfall. Brightline remains the deadliest passenger train in the country. And is the Trump administration's immigration crackdown affecting assisted living facilities? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo.
Certainly there are concerns about parks. There are concerns about many things.
In the next hour, I'll talk with Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava about her proposed budget for the new fiscal year. We'll also go behind the curtain for WLRN and the Miami Herald's new podcast, Killer Train. And we'll ask how the Trump administration's immigration agenda is affecting a South Florida assisted living facility. All that coming up right after the news. The South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. Tim Padgett is out this week. As one fiscal year ends, another one begins. Miami-Dade County is starting that process right now. Just this week, County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava presented her proposed budget for the 2025-2026 fiscal year, which starts October 1st. This year's budget, however, has been especially difficult for the county. As it stands, the county is in a $402 million deficit, one of the largest in recent years. To help close that gap, the mayor is proposing some serious administrative belt tightening. Her nearly $13 billion spending plan includes consolidating six county offices, increasing rates for public transit, and eliminating more than 350 job positions in an effort to balance the books. I spoke with Mayor Levine Cava yesterday about her proposed budget and what she believes the county should do moving forward. There's a $402 million hole in the budget right now. You've offered some solutions to that, like a 50-cent transit fare increase, closing two tax-funded senior centers, adding a $5 park fee. When you add these things up, there are impacts to some of the county's most vulnerable and low-income residents, but ultimately all county residents may be affected in some way. Could you walk us through what your top priorities were while developing this budget, and where did you draw the line when it came to what to protect or cut?
Yes, it's very painful, $402 million, and we are only talking about the general fund. So it's not airport, seaport, water and sewer, waste. Those things are all funded by proprietary funds and fees, same with our fire department, with our library. So there's only a certain number of departments where we can economize to bridge that gap. So it was very painful. Mm-hmm. So we had to look at what were the core services that people rely upon every single day. They want their trash picked up. They want to be able to ride the public transit. Those are just some of the examples of things that we really couldn't touch. And ultimately, general fund is the major source of support for parks, for transportation and public works, for our law enforcement, our sheriff, and our corrections. So we were very restricted in what we could do. We had a lot of things that are covered by outside grants. We tried to move some services into grant-funded programs, but in the end of the day, we had to make sacrifices. We've reduced salaries in the executive staff. We've consolidated some departments to reduce overhead. And with all of it, we've eliminated over 300 positions, about half of which are currently occupied. So
right.
Some folks will lose jobs.
And I want to get to that in just a second, Mayor. But you, in your press conference this week, mentioned that your proposed budget does not affect public transit services like Metrobus, Metro Mover, and Metro Rail. Are you confident that this year's budget will protect access to these services?
So as you mentioned, we are proposing a small fare increase, and yet we know that does affect people who are on tight budgets. The fares have not gone up in 10 years, mm-hmm. so 50 cents per ride. And we also have more free service than any other major metro that I'm aware of. But we have a lot of free fare between the Golden Passport, the Metro Mover, and other subsidies for people of low income and students. So there's a lot of subsidy that goes into that already. Mm-hmm. And we are also, fortunately, growing our transit ridership because we know that the fare box does never cover the full cost. And we've had to subsidize it with general fund, which has been cut. Also at the state, we had money that was a part of rental tax on businesses that was eliminated. And with it went about $27 million. That was part of our transit system.
Right, Mayor, but are you confident that the commission will agree with you on maintaining these services and not touching them so that you make some room for that 402 million?
So obviously, we've spoken to all of these commissioners multiple times prior to submitting this budget to try to get their input and try to seek consensus at the other end. Certainly, there are concerns about parks. There are concerns about many things. And will some of them try to move from one category to another? I have no doubt that there will be those discussions. At the end of the day, we have tried really hard to focus on the very core services. And I do think that transit is one of them. People need to get to work, they need to get to their appointments. And we've worked hard to rebuild our transit system and make it one of the strongest in the nation. We actually went from 15th to 10th largest transit system in the country since the pandemic, and we're the most recovered post-pandemic. So I hate to think about going backwards and the disruption that that would cause.
Mayor, your budget, like you mentioned, also includes some job cuts. 360, to my understanding, of which, to your point, 140 are currently filled. Do you expect these layoffs to affect direct services residents rely on day to day?
Some of it will. For example, if we reduce programming in parks, that will be difficult for people who rely on our parks, which are certainly very popular and more so post-pandemic. That's why we're looking for partnerships. We also have some offices that I had created that have fulfilled their purpose. Some of them are being funded now with grant dollars. For example, our housing advocacy office, which has been a lifeline for thousands of people facing difficulty paying for housing, that will be moving into the Housing and Community Development Department, where federal funds will pick it up. And we pray that the federal government maintains those HUD dollars. That's really essential for all of us. The Office of New Americans has been helping people to obtain citizenship. We are working with a network of nonprofits that provide those services. So naturally, we'll be connecting people to those services. And Office of Neighborhood Safety, which is all about crime prevention, still has the dollars from the Peace and Prosperity Plan. So that will continue.
District 6 Commissioner Natalie Million Orbis issued a statement saying your budget proposal, quote, betrays the people it's supposed to serve. She suggests the county cut inefficiencies, not essential services. Mayor, what's your response to that? And are you prepared to compromise with commissioners on this?
Yeah, so we have been working on our WISE 305 initiative that I announced several months back. But since I've come into office, we've looked at ways that we could consolidate services. And one of the things we've done is consolidate six departments into three. I've actually consolidated several others in the past. So, I think unfortunately, people can say that these things are not efficient, but honestly, they are maybe not as close as we are, and our team working around the clock to find those efficiencies. We even are we have a team that is focused just on efficiencies. So, we welcome suggestions from commissioners should they have ideas maybe that we haven't identified, but I do think we've done a very good job to find efficiencies and be accountable to the public.
Mayor, and I understand this is a process for you, your administration, but there are reactions from the community. What's your response to residents who feel they're paying more but getting less through this proposal?
I personally am in a great deal of pain, and I find it very, very concerning that we're having to cut back on some of our nonprofit groups, some of our cultural groups. These are things that are very, very hard. At the end of the day, there is a $400 million budget gap, and there are only a certain number of areas where we can look for those savings. So the tax rate is the lowest since 1982. We rolled the tax rate back 2 years in a row. And I also want to emphasize, I propose a budget, but the commission finally approves a budget. So every single year, we bring forward a budget, and the commission has questions, and we make some changes. And ultimately, the budget is a document that is passed by the county commission.
Mayor, I want to go back a little bit. Your administration has defined this as a, quote, fair and balanced budget that protects critical services in the county while facing what you've called a perfect storm of fiscal pressures. Could you walk us through how the county ended up with a $402 million deficit?
Yes, I'll explain about this perfect storm, which unfortunately is the case. First of all, we have had these new offices, the constitutional offices. That's five offices that had previously been more of part of the county-wide budget, all from the same pot of money. We now have to gear up for five additional county agencies. So each of them has their own needs for administration. In some cases, they're expanding service. That all comes out of the same pot. We also have had already cutbacks in state funding and federal funding. I think people are following that in the news, and it has had a significant impact on us. We also are not experiencing the same growth in the economy and property values. That means less money coming in from property taxes. We also have higher costs, just like everyone. Our costs have gone up phenomenally, and we're looking at even more with tariffs and other headwinds. And we've also had increasing demand for services. So at the end of the day, of all of the $402 million, over $100 million of it comes from just one of the constitutional offices, the tax collector, because that office takes the money off the top. And if it's anything left over, it will come back to our general fund, which we're hopeful there will be some. But we have no ability to plan for it. We need to wait to see what is left from the tax collector's own operations.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. I'm speaking with Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levin-Cava about her proposed budget for the new fiscal year. I want to talk about those five state-mandated constitutional offices. Roughly how much of the proposed budget, I know you mentioned the tax collector is about $100 million off the top of the budget, how much is being allocated to these offices specifically from this?
Yeah. So the 44% of the 402 specifically is for the new constitutional offices. And just remember, we budgeted what we thought was a fair growth for each of them at about 8% growth. And we, on the contrary, cut the general fund to the county by 10%. And to achieve that, some departments took cuts of up to 35%. So we've understood we have to share the same pot of money. We're not proposing to grow the tax rolls. In fact, we've proposed a flat millage, so no increase in property taxes. Mm-hmm. And yet now we have these other offices, and some of them did ask for substantially more than what we suggested. And we've talked to them, and they've come down in their requests. So we've been able to accommodate their needs. As I said, the tax collector has a different situation because he doesn't come to us first to incorporate his budget into ours. And we have to wait and see. As for the sheriff, yes, the sheriff has asked for more than what we have proposed. And obviously that will be discussed by the commission.
Right, which I actually want to ask you about later on. But I wanted to ask you about Amendment 10, which is what created the mandate for these offices back in 2018. Some say the county had time to prepare for this move. In fact, over the last couple of years, WLRN has spoken to some of your colleagues on the commission who suggested that this specific year's budget would be tough for the county as a result. I want to play part of an interview from last year when District 7 Commissioner Raquel Regalado came on the show. She spoke about the impact these new offices would make.
This is the most significant thing that has happened in Miami-Dade County since the creation of single-member districts. The impact on our finances is astronomical, and for many, many years, the county didn't deal with it. When I got elected in 2020, that was one of my big complaints, like, why aren't we dealing with this?
Mayor, could you tell us what steps the county took to prepare for this change ahead of it, and did you anticipate it to be this costly?
So Commissioner Regalado absolutely has been the most vocal on the commission about the need to prepare. And in fact, revenues were set aside in reserves, not at the level that she recommended. And we also in the administration have been seeking greater reserves and not spending all of the funds, for example, that we got from the rescue plan. So again, I just want to remind you and the listeners, the budget is passed by the commission. And so whereas I may have put funds aside, maybe the commission wanted to spend more money and increased the budget at the final round. So we did anticipate, we did put aside reserves. We couldn't know how much it would be until these new electeds came into office and prepared their budget. We have worked very hard, especially over the last 2 years, on the transition. And unfortunately, we really could not anticipate this large a difference. And now here we are. I want to point out that last year, we had a projected $200 million budget shortfall. And my administration worked very hard to bridge that gap and was able to do so. So it makes it that much more challenging this year, but we managed to do it. And again, there is a lot of pain. There's a lot of sacrifice in this budget. And unfortunately, that is the reality.
I want to ask you about something you just mentioned, Mayor Sheriff Rosie Cordero Stutz. You're proposing a $55 million increase to her office. She says they need more than that. She said they need at least $35 to $40 million more dollars than what you've proposed to ensure public safety. She said if she doesn't get it, you're essentially defunding the police. How do you respond to that statement?
You know, I have been a tremendous supporter of our law enforcement men and women. In my first term as mayor, the budget for police was increased on average 8% every year. So I also finally provided raises and some reclassifications for critical positions that had been long stalled. So I think it's well recognized that I significantly recommended and the commission agreed to invest in our law enforcement. So this year, in fact, we are recommending even higher, a 9% increase. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're working closely. In fact, I just met with the sheriff to go over some of the numbers as she sees it, and I will be talking to my budget team so we can all try to get on the same page. Fortunately, we really have presented what we think is a reasonable growth and should suffice because that's what we've done for many years past and have one of the best safety records in the country. We're considered one of the safest metropolitan areas. That to be said, we certainly know she needs to continue to hire officers. We know she needs to gear up for World Cup. We certainly agree that public safety is number one.
Mayor, you've emphasized that this budget avoids raising the tax rate. Commissioners this week voted to accept your recommendations to keep property tax rates flat. Have you considered raising the tax rate, or is that not an option right now?
Well, first of all, it's not possible to raise the tax rate after the vote yesterday at the commission. So they set the highest possible millage at the first hearing, and then there's a second hearing at which they set the final millage, and it can go down, but it cannot go up. So I think it's responsible to keep it flat, to continue to provide the savings that were realized with the two tax cuts that we recommended and were approved in the past. Again, we're at the lowest property tax rate since 1982. So that is very significant. And we know that people are really struggling. The cost of living in Miami-Dade County is very, very high. Mm-hmm. We certainly are seeing the strain. People can't afford housing. And by the way, one of our biggest investments, and certainly my top priority, has been housing that people can afford. And that's one of the ways that we did increase the budget. We doubled the amount of money in the county budget. We're blessed. We have a surtax program, which allows us to invest directly in housing development. We've got 17,000 units in the pipeline for affordable and workforce housing. And in fact, we have contributed greatly to the stabilization of the rental market.
Mayor, are there any measures you're considering to address the county's financial challenges in the long term? What's your vision to restore the county's financial foundation?
I think we have to think of it as a new county government, just like Commissioner Regalado said. It's smaller because we now have splintered off various of the functions that were under my supervision, right? Police, tax collector, election supervisor, those were all departments. We did have the independent clerk and the independent property appraiser, but we were much more aligned working together on the administrative side, and now we have more administration. So I think it's a new look. We need to really make sure that we can afford the basic services. I think that's always going to be most critical. And we have to fight to prevent state and federal cuts that are going to really hurt our community. And we are already experiencing that. We put out a very lengthy report on the cuts that have already been realized at the federal and state level. We have received some dollars still for certain things, but overall, it's been greatly reduced, and we're very worried about other cuts that are coming down.
And finally, Mayor, while we have you here, we do want to acknowledge the immigrant detention center in the Everglades dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. Over the past few weeks, people have been urging the county to take action and sue the state and federal government over this facility, which happens to be on county-owned land. You've made a request to have more visibility and access to the site, which was seemingly denied. Is the county planning on taking legal action? And maybe what are your next steps?
Yeah, I'm very, very concerned about this facility on our property in the middle of the Everglades. I wrote a letter regarding the effects on the environment. Of course, there's a separate lawsuit by independent groups about that. Very, very worried about those impacts. This is our water supply, the aquifer. This is federally protected land. This was not done with the requisite approvals by any means using the governor's emergency powers. The attorneys, at my request, are reviewing all legal avenues. At the end of the day, just like the budget, the decision to file a lawsuit is the responsibility of the commission. I do not have the authority to file a lawsuit without their approval. And clearly, we are concerned. We asked for the monitoring. I wouldn't say definitively that it's been turned down. My letter was to Kevin Guthrie, the director of the Division of Emergency Management, which has oversight for the facility. I am waiting to hear his response. I asked for video camera surveillance access, as well as frequent monitoring visits, as well as a weekly report on the status. Since I did that, there are other concerns that have arisen, humanitarian concerns, access to legal counsel. Right. All of this is really of great worry to me and to all of us.
That was my conversation Thursday with Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levin-Cava about her proposed budget for the new fiscal year. Still to come, the findings of a year-long investigation by WLRN and the Miami Herald into Brightline. It's the focus of a new podcast called Killer Train. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. Tim Padgett is out this week. Brightline is the first private passenger train to open in the U.S. in more than a century, and it's hailed as a national model for the future of rail. However, since the train line launched in 2018, South Floridians have recognized the high-speed rail service more for making headlines around its fatal accidents. Brightline remains the deadliest passenger train in the country by far, according to federal data. A year-long investigation by WLRN News and the Miami Herald uncovers a glaring dark side. The death toll has surpassed 180 people, and safeguards are still lacking. The question is, why is Brightline so deadly? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Joining me now to walk us through their investigative process and its findings are the co-hosts of the new podcast, Killer Train, the Miami Herald's Brittany Wallman and WLRN's Danny Rivero. Thank you for joining us. Before we dive into this conversation, I want to warn listeners that there will be some discussion around suicide. If you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, know that help is available. You can contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988 or text HELLO to 741-741. Brittany, tell me about the scope of this investigation. How long did it take?
Well, we started a year ago, July. And we knew we wanted to understand how many deaths there were. We knew it was being underreported over the years, and also the circumstances of all of these deaths, and that it wasn't going to be easy. And we had to compile records from federal data, medical examiners, law enforcement. It was kind of like someone just throwing four different puzzles on the floor in a pile and trying to then piece them all together into the to get the real picture that we published earlier this week.
Yeah, you talk about some documents you had to go through to find, like, to understand these deaths, the numbers, the circumstances. What kind of documents did you look through?
A lot of really disturbing autopsy reports, reports from the scenes of these horrific, gruesome train deaths, police reports, federal data, just trying, and then also news reports, and trying to match them all up and create a complete list with a complete count. And that is how we found that 182 people had been killed by this train, which is about one every 13 days on average.
Wow. And Danny, can you take us a step back? As I mentioned at the outset, Brightline is hailed as the future of rail. Prior to its launch, people were excited about the alternative to driving that this private train company offers. What exactly attracted Brightline to South Florida, and vice versa? What benefits did lawmakers see with this new form of transportation?
Right. So that's also part of the reason that we wanted to do this reporting in the first place, is because, you know, a 7 years into operations, the train has become hailed as a model for, you know, America can build trains, we can run trains again. And it's excited a lot of people. It's a private company doing this. But we were watching it in, you know, from our seats as reporters and as citizens here, and saying, why are so many people dying here? Like, what is going on? And it's been known for several years that it was the deadliest train by mile, according to the federal data. We also knew we probably didn't have the full picture either. So we wanted to understand, okay, if this is the model, why are so many people dying? Like, it's like that can't, it shouldn't be the model in that sense. And to figure out the full scope of the answer there. But what attracted Brightline to South Florida is they're in the same umbrella company as the Florida East Coast Railway, which already owns the tracks. So the tracks are already there. They were already laid out. The right. Brightline company has the rights to run trains on it. So a lot of, you know, the discussion we hear about, you know, can high-speed rail work in California? That was not the case down here, because the tracks were already there and they already had the rights to the tracks. They just had to build some stations and get it running.
And just to clarify, do other trains run along these tracks as well, or is it just Brightline?
Right. So the Florida East Coast Railway does continue to run freight trains on those tracks, which sometimes are very long and they take a long time to cross, but they move much slower than Brightline trains. Mm-hmm. Here in South Florida, between West Palm and Miami, it runs at up to 79 miles per hour. North of West Palm, it runs up to 110 till Cocoa, and then between Cocoa and Orlando, it goes up to 125 miles per hour.
Wow. And Brittany, from 2017 to now, Brightline trains have struck and killed 182 people, as you mentioned. I know your investigation focused on the causes of these deaths. Brightline claims a majority of them are, quote, confirmed or suspected suicide. What do your findings say?
Right. That's what I consider a myth that we busted. It had often been repeated in the media because Brightline says it so often. But actually, 75 of the 182, which is far fewer than half, it's about 41%, were officially ruled suicide by medical examiners. Mm-hmm. So as you can see, more than half were not.
Yeah.
And you know, to jump off that, it's not that that suicides don't happen. They do. And then when you're running a train at street level in a place like that, you know, like South Florida, it's very densely populated. You know, the families of some survivors have even told us, they've said, you know, I know you can't prevent every one of them. But by debunking this and actually saying, really laying it down factually that most of them were not suicides, it brings up, we can have a conversation about, okay, what went wrong in these other circumstances? Because the majority were accidents, or, you know, they were actually undetermined what exactly happened. So that's a big gaping hole. I mean, these are many people dead, and we don't exactly know why, or right. We didn't going into this.
Right, and apart from the 182 deaths, you also found that 99 people have been injured, and there are 101 cases where vehicles have been hit with no injuries. Were these accidents and deaths predictable or avoidable?
Absolutely. And I think that was an important piece of our investigation, was that this is a corridor, as you mentioned, that the freight trains run along it. So there's a long history here where trespassing, as they call it, which is people walking across the tracks in between crossings, was epidemic. I mean, a lot of people have been killed by freight trains along this corridor. And one could see that if you're going to be introducing a very fast train on tracks where a lot of people have already died, it's, you know, might not work out so well.
Right. And another big indicator that I think we'll be exploring more in the podcast, and we talked about it in the article published this week, was on top of running faster trains through these neighborhoods and whatnot, the federal government also allowed the trains to start running without blowing the horns. Which we know historically, factually, means more people are going to die when you do that.
And what's the reason behind why they allowed for these like silent horn sections?
A lot of it is local governments and local elected representatives. They're trying to satisfy people that live close to the railroad tracks. They don't want to hear the trains and the train horns. But I mean, that's the dilemma here. The train horns are for safety because people live close to the tracks. Right. If you don't blow the horns, that's a detriment to public safety. The horns are there for safety. That's the whole point of them.
Right. And Danny, how has Brightline addressed the number of deaths along this train route?
So Brightline has, you know, even prior to running, they did do a lot of safety upgrades to the crossings. After they started running, they've received, some grant money, and they put a lot of money into it themselves to make more upgrades. They put medians in between some roads so that cars can't cross over to the other side where there's no arm, and then cross kind of illegally across the tracks. They have put fencing in some places, certainly not all places. Legally, Brightline has done everything they are required to do. Mm-hmm. A big question that we kind of start to approach is, what more could they do? Or, you know, are the laws that are on the books adequate for the reality of this train?
Yeah.
It's not that the company hasn't crossed T's and dotted I's. It's just clearly something's not working, because people are still dying almost, you know, on average, every 13 days, according to our reporting.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Brittany Wallman and WLRN's Danny Rivero about their new podcast, Killer Train. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Brittany, you spoke to victims' families for this investigation. Amy Brunell is the mother of 18-year-old Madison Maddie Brunell. She was the first person struck and killed by a Brightline train in 2017 in Boca Raton. Maddie was diagnosed as bipolar, and in a manic state, she took her own life by walking onto the Brightline tracks. Here's a clip of Amy from episode 1 of Killer Train.
I've been down to Atlantic Avenue and all through that area, and it's so easy for somebody to get hit. It's so easy, even if they're not intending to. And it's like, and it's just open fest to anybody.
Danny just mentioned some safety upgrades that Brightline has implemented. What have you guys heard from families about these upgrades, and do they think that there's enough being done to reduce deaths?
No, they don't. One of the most rewarding things in reporting this has been just giving voice to the family members of the people that have been struck by the train. They feel like for example, in Maddie's case, there's way too much open track. We, as a reporting team, went to the scene where she stepped in front of that train, and it is just fenceless. It's open. She walked out of a recovery center, you know, looked to her right, and there's open track, and it was an impulsive act, I guess you could say. And so a lot of the family members have expressed to us that they don't feel the infrastructure. That's what really signals to you a danger. You know, if there's only two little gates and you can just walk right on by and the signage doesn't really scare you whatsoever, then you know, you would have no idea that this high-speed train is about to come barreling through.
And the infrastructure is a big thing. In Amy Brunell's case, I mean, she's from Connecticut. She looks at the trains where she's from, and she says the infrastructure does not allow people to just walk onto the tracks.
Right.
Dan Johansson, who we also had in the article, and he'll be in a coming podcast episode, he's from the Chicago area. He's like, you cannot, there's guardrails in many ways to stop people from just going onto the track. So there's a big infrastructure question here.
Right. And your investigation is already getting some traction in the federal government. They're already talking about this. Specifically, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy reacted to your reporting during a congressional committee meeting on Wednesday. He and Democratic Miami Congresswoman Frederica Wilson demanded solutions. Here's Duffy at that meeting.
In regard to Brightline, I think is what you're referring to. There are way too many deaths there, and I know that there's it's a big story in regard to just people not following traffic signs. There's some suicides and there's accidents as well. And I commit to working with you to drive down the number of deaths, making investments along that line. So I'd welcome that opportunity.
Danny, we're really short on time, but in the last 30 seconds, what have you heard from Brightline and what do you think about the federal government's reaction?
So after publication, I mean, Brightline has stressed to us from the very beginning that they've done everything up to any regulation that they've been required to do and more, and safety is a top concern for them. It is really something to hear the top transportation person in the entire country in the Trump administration talking about our reporting, and we'll just have to see where this carries on.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
We'll have to leave it there for now. The Miami Herald's Brittany Wallman and WLRN's Danny Rivero are the hosts of the new podcast, Killer Train. Thank you both for joining us. You can visit WLRN.org/Killer Train to view the full report. Episode 2 of the podcast comes out on Tuesday, July 22nd. Still to come, how the Trump administration's immigration crackdown is affecting a South Florida senior community. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. It's been about 6 months since President Donald Trump returned to office. Since then, as we've discussed on this show, several immigration programs have been rolled back, like Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, and the Biden-era Humanitarian Parole Program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. These programs allowed tens of thousands of people to live and work in the U.S. legally. As a result of these changes, several industries across the country are feeling the impacts. Today, we're taking a closer look at how these immigration policy shifts are affecting assisted living facilities, or ALFs. These centers are especially vital in a state like Florida, where 20% of the population is currently 65 and older, according to the Florida Department of Elder Affairs. By 2030, projections estimate that more than 1 in 4 Floridians will be part of this age group. With such a rapidly growing population, the demand for ALFs will likely rise. According to the Agency for Healthcare Administration, there are 3,000 ALFs in Florida, providing more than 106,000 beds statewide. One South Florida center in particular is already feeling the pressure, the Toby and Leon Cooperman Sinai Residences in Boca Raton. The facility has lost employees as a result of recent immigration changes and expects to lose more in the next couple of months. Joining us now to discuss the situation is Rachel Blumberg, the CEO of the Palm Beach County-based retirement community. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here today.
Of course. So, Rachel, to start us off, could you tell us a little bit more about Sinai Residences? How many residents do you have and what kind of needs do they have?
Sure. We're our senior living community, home to more than 500 older adults. We offer the full range of services from independent living, assisted living, memory care, short-term rehabilitation, and long-term skilled nursing care.
So how many employees do you roughly have at the moment?
We have about 430 employees are on our payroll.
Yeah, and Rachel, as I mentioned at the outset, several immigration programs have been cut by the Trump administration. Has your center been affected by these changes in immigration policy?
Absolutely. About 8% of my workforce is affected by TPS. We've already seen ramifications through the termination of the CHNV parole program, where we lost 10 employees. And there's some confusion and some misunderstanding in the public by the term, the CHNV parole program. It's really a humanitarian program. These individuals were not criminals. They were upstanding employees, hardworking individuals that took the legal path to be in America, to live and work here with the legal work authorization that was ripped away from them literally overnight. So it was a Thursday night, the federal government ended the program, and the next day, unfortunately, we had to face each of the individuals to let them know that the federal government had revoked their work authorization. They were no longer allowed to work or live in America, and they were ordered to immediately self-deport. It was incredibly heartbreaking.
And those were 10 employees, right?
Those were 10. We have 30 more employees that are on TPS. And if that decision is not amended or rescinded, or if we don't see things like the Dignity Act accepted, then we face losing 30 more employees, which is 8% of my workforce.
And before we move forward, I do want to just clarify that that CHNV program that you mentioned is that program I mentioned at the top for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans,
yes,
and Venezuelans.
Correct. It is. So CHNV is kind of like a branch of TPS. TPS began in 1990 with President Bush, and over the years, it's taken on some modifications.
Right.
So CHNV is one of those. And that one began about 2 years ago. And yes, it was Nicaraguan, Venezuelan, Haitian, Cuban immigrants that came over. And it was unfortunately abruptly ended.
Right.
And now we have TPS remaining. But yes, they are one of the same, essentially.
Yeah. And Rachel, before we move forward, I do want to ask you about the day that that happened. Mm-hmm. Could you clarify how many of those employees you just discussed were medical employees, if at all, or maintenance, or on your staff for other services?
They all contribute to our operations. It's actually the entire range of all four corners, if you will, of our operation. Of course, our essential workers, like our nurses and our certified nursing aides, our caregivers, are critically essential. But we lost other essential workers, like you said, maintenance technicians, culinary employees, cooks, dishwashers, housekeepers. It truly affected every aspect of our operation because all of these employees and their jobs are essential to our 24/7 operation.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. I'm speaking with Rachel Blumberg, the CEO of the Toby and Leon Cooperman Sinai Residences in Boca Raton, about how the Trump administration's immigration crackdown has affected the assisted living facility. Take us back to that day when you learned that your employees under the CHNV program were essentially not authorized to work in the country anymore.
Yeah, it was awful. We found out on a Thursday night and said, okay, you know, it was already in the evening after 5 o'clock. What are we going to do? So my human resources team and I decided to come in early Friday morning to meet with the individuals affected. Many of them were not aware of the change. It was not a publicly broadcasted decision. There was a very quiet message on the federal government that the program had been terminated. Individuals did receive an email, but if they didn't log into the federal government's website, they didn't know the content of that email was telling them to self-deport. I met with them with at least one or two of my HR team individually out of respect for each individual. Mm-hmm. We didn't feel like a group setting would be dignified. I think the positive side is that we were able to share this information with heart, mm-hmm, compassion, and with dignity, with care, with a hug. It was horrific news to have to share it with somebody, but we were able to look them in the eyes and tell them how much we care about them,
right.
Let them know if the decision is changed. They always have a job with us. We did give each of them $2,000. There's no amount of money that will help anybody in this circumstance because they don't know where to go. They don't know what the plan will be for their future. There was a lot of confusion from the individuals that we spoke to that weren't clear on why this happened. And I just kept telling them, you've done nothing wrong. You have done absolutely nothing wrong. Unfortunately, it's just because of where you were born and that this program was terminated. But it was heartbreaking. It felt like a funeral. And I felt so helpless. I wanted to so badly to say this wasn't real, it wasn't happening. But it was the cold, hard facts and reality of the decisions that were made that we had to enforce.
And Rachel, what's been the most immediate impact to your day-to-day operations since you've lost these employees?
My human resources team has been feverishly working to replace them. We have to utilize other people to fill in the gaps with overtime. And, we're doing the best that we can to manage. In total, we're looking at 40 positions that we have to replace between TPS and CHNV. It's a huge strain on the organization as a whole. It's stressful. It's sad for my residents who have incredibly strong bonds with these individuals. They're not just employees. They become part of a family to our residents. So the relationships are very deep when you've become accustomed to spending each and every day with a caregiver or an employee that you've grown to know so well. Mm-hmm. It's more than politics. It's a matter of the heart. It's matters of humanity. And to me, those are the deepest cuts of all when it comes to this circumstance.
Right. Have you heard from residents? How have they responded to the loss of some of this staff? And have they felt the impact of the latest changes at your center?
Without a doubt. Our residents want to know what they can do. They've been writing our elected officials, calling them. They have offered everything under the sun regarding ideas on how they can help overcome this problem. How can they save these individuals? They are heartbroken. They are in tears. They want to be problem solvers. They want to help be the solution. But ultimately, this decision really lies in the federal government's hands. We have to go through the courts and we have to go through the appeal decision. And hopefully the reintroduction of the Dignity Act may...
I just want to clarify to listeners that the Dignity Act of 2025 is a bill that Miami Republican Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar is getting behind. She's reproposing the bill, which would have migrants pay restitution to legally remain in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Rachel, you told the Associated Press this situation is the, quote, tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Because I think it's a ripple effect. I think there's a cascade is not changed. If this decision does stand firm, as it does look right now, the way I see it is I can only forecast the individuals. So for my community, we have identified 40 individuals out of our 430 that we will lose. But what I cannot forecast, and I don't think anybody can forecast, are all of the other factors that you cannot see below the 10% of the iceberg. So the 10% of the iceberg you can see is the top, and 90% you cannot see below. Mm-hmm. To me, what those factors are, what about an employee who, let's say they have a parent who cares for their child and that parent is deported? That employee will no longer be able to come to work because they don't have somebody to care for their child. Or what about the employee whose significant other or loved one is being deported and they leave the country with them because they're forced to? So there's another loss of an employee. I think there are so many different variables that we can't even begin to wrap our heads around to predict. And so that's why I think it's the tip of the iceberg, because although there are 1.3 million individuals affected by TPS, they all have loved ones and family members that are not quantified and counted for. And where will they go? What will happen to them?
Right. Rachel, we'll have to leave it there for time. Rachel Blumberg is the CEO of the Toby and Leon Cooperman Sinai Residences in Boca Raton. Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royale. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Helen Acevedo. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.
WL.